Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, NVIDIA GTX 1180 or 2080. Is it time to stop buying new GPUs? Is Microsoft's new Surface Go too slow to bother with? 5G, it's getting real. And AMD's B450 chipset looks like a winner. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 477, recorded on August 2nd, 2018. Surface Go or Surface No?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, most expensive, most outrageous, most practical hardware news and reviews available in any known or unknown universe. Read that known or heretofore unknown universe line in a contract once, and I've just enjoyed saying it ever since. That is the healthy chuckle of Mr. Ryan Trout from PCPerd.com. Yo, we have two exciting stories. Actually, we have more than two exciting stories, but the two that kind of are at the top, one from AMD, one from Microsoft. Which would you like to start with, sir?
Let's go with the order as they are presented on the sheet, I guess.
All right. So Tech Thing, the show the weekly show I do, TEKTHING, we had a viewer question about Ryzen 2 processors, which are a fantastic value if you are building your own PC or buying a new PC, which is why they are pretty much all that is recommended on PCPer's leaderboard, their list of system builds. So if you need a little help putting together the next system you want for gaming or content creation or just general computer usage. And of course, the day after, I talk about the 2600 and the 2600X and the 2700 and the 2700X. And I got to say, if you're looking at Core i5s, just buy a Ryzen 2600 or 2600X. And then, like the day after I do that, AMD announces the B450 chipset for Ryzen. And this is basically the idea is a lot of the stories you'll see on this online are basically like, AMD makes overclocking more affordable than the 470, which is true. But you know, there's have been other affordable overclocking chipsets for the Ryzen processors, just not that support the latest features in the Ryzen 2 series CPUs. Yeah. But this is pretty good. I mean, first of all, the thing I love the most reading the write-up that Josh did over at PCPer. This is my favorite line in the whole thing. Quote, AMD plans to support this socket to at least 2020, and most AM4 boards should be able to handle upcoming CPUs with a BIOS update, which is a polite way of saying, Mr. Norton, we understand that you can't use your first generation motherboard and get all of the power benefits of our second generation Ryzen processors. But that's okay, because if you buy a second generation Ryzen processor, your motherboard will go at least through 2020, which is, you know, a year and a half away, which is much better than, say, 6 months from now. It's the 470 is still the top of the line. But when you look at like the X470, X370, B450, and the B350 are all overclocking enabled. You got to dip down into the first generation A320 chipset to get something that doesn't do overclocking. It's exciting. Or maybe I just get excited about chipsets now because we haven't had one in a while.
No, I mean, I think the interesting thing here is the value proposition that it offers, right? The B450 has, you know, CPU overclocking, memory overclocking supported. AMD Storium I technology, which is their kind of multi-tiered caching. They don't like to use the term caching, but, you know, whatever you want to call it, storage system. So you can combine an SSD and a hard drive into a single faster accelerated unit. It does not support CPU PCIe bifurcation, which is really something really only targeted at extreme enthusiasts, right? If you're going to have multiple M.2 cards on a single PCIe bus through one of those Asus M.2 splitters. That's where you really get into that. But if you're not doing M.2 RAID, essentially the performance and capabilities are pretty much equitable across the board. Now, the differences you may see, there may be other differences you find that are from just the board vendors integrating or not integrating specific features on these boards because of their price points, right? If you scroll down and you look at, you know, AMD's kind of claiming that an AMD 450, B450 motherboard is going to be like in the $69, $70 range.
That's awesome.
Which really sets you up for some interesting comparisons. They compare, you know, a Z370, which is still required if you want to go with the Core i5, the K-series unlocked parts, the 8600Ks that they use in this example. You know, you can save $100 if you're going with a Raven Ridge. If you want integrated graphics, you're going to get much better integrated graphics performance, the ability to overclock and play around with the speeds and feeds on that one. Or if you just want to go towards more performance, you can go up to the Ryzen 5 2600. It's a little bit more expensive processor, and you're still saving about $90 on that entire build out, right? Which is impressive, right? You're still going to get SATA, NVMe, USB 3.1, Gen 2, PCIe lanes for you know, add-in cards and what have you. There's a lot of value there, and that's really what AMD is leaning into for these mid-range parts. B450 is just an extension of what they were able to do with B350. I think there were a lot of people that built Ryzen platforms first gen that just use the B series motherboards, and they don't need the X series. That's you know, can doesn't always, but can cost you $50, $60, $70 more.
Right.
And on the Intel side, you don't really have that option with their most recent Coffee-like series of parts. Still,
if I were to be cranky, I might suggest that Intel has done everything it could to complicate the lives of anybody that wanted to upgrade by creating as many different motherboard options and dropping them with new processors. But I'm just a little frustrated with Intel in general right now. This is good, because I was just about to buy a new motherboard, and now I'm like, I may be looking for a mini ITX or micro ITX B450 instead of the one I was originally going to buy. But this is good. AMD, I mean, I just feel like AMD is just kind of marching along and doing some really nice work. So,
yeah,
good stuff. You have a shiny silver 10-inch laptop. Well, it's more of a tablet. I mean, really, it's a Surface Go. Quote, the best 10-inch device for first-line workers. What's the first-line worker? That's Microsoft. That's off the... that's right off the Microsoft.com/en-us/surface/business/surface-go. Keep scrolling down after the happy feet. Keep going. Look, it's a Surface, but smaller. Honey, they shrunk the Surface.
Interesting. I'll say this. It is definitely small, right? Like, I'm trying to think. I have an iPad Pro. It's a 10-inch as well. But this, because it comes with a keyboard, if I take my iPhone 10 and kind of put it on the back of it, you get a sense of where you're at on scope and size. It's going to be much smaller than any laptop that most of us are using. It's very light. It has two ports on it now, right? It has the Surface Connect, and it has a Type-C, USB Type-C connection as well. And then it has the connection on the bottom for your attachable keyboard. What are your thoughts on what they're trying to do here with this form factor, with this price point?
You know, I see a lot of people... I feel, I'm going to use, you know, feel. I'm going to tie my statement to me here in the group while everybody's listening. I feel that there are some pretty heavy lines being drawn by the manufacturers, if less so by the actual consumers, where they have this idea that there are these people out there, these consumers, these users, these first line workers that need to display content, do basic email, and have style and portability as their number one needs, and everything else kind of gets thrown by the wayside. And which in some ways makes sense. And you could also say, like, you know, maybe this is their shot across the bow of you know, Apple's professional laptops. But you know, I find myself more often than not being frustrated by a lot of these configurations. I mean, first of all, you know, it's $449 for a 64 gigabyte version with 4 gigabytes of RAM. Yep. It's $600 to bump it up to 8 gigabytes of RAM. You know, this is, you know, in some ways I look at like a Dell XPS 2-in-1, the smaller 2-in-1, where they use the super low power processor. And as long as you don't tax it, it's fine. And is if your primary need is to do have a very small amount of space afforded to your computing, it's fantastic. Right. For me, it gets frustrating because as soon as I try to do a lot of the things I need to do on a daily or weekly basis, there's not enough processing power, and I get really frustrated really fast. One question I had was, does this, it does include the type cover?
No, I don't think it does.
Oh, yeah, no, here it is. Okay. The way they, the paragraph is constructed, Surface Go Signature type cover and then the line that's cut off below that says Surface Pen sold separately. So basically, if you want to type on it, it's another $100. And,
right.
You know.
Which you will. Because it's still Windows. It's still fundamentally not a fantastic touchscreen only like tablet interface. It's fine in some applications. But I would say in general, this is not a device where you should try to use it without that keyboard.
Nine hours kind of video playback, which does not.
Yeah, the battery life's an interesting thing. We've had it in for a couple of days. I was out of town, so I haven't spent much time with it yet. But Ken did run our battery life test on it, and it got just under 5 hours in our battery life test. And our battery life test is pretty strenuous. I consider it to be more realistic for how people actually utilize a laptop when they're browsing the internet and actually getting work done.
I just laugh because there's so many of these battery tests are like, you know, we took a video, loaded it into memory, and then ran it with the screen turned most of the way out. And just like you, we got 13 hours of battery life. And then you actually, you know, start browsing web pages and the battery life cuts by 30%, 40%. You know, this is, I'm with you. This is, I think this is, okay, first of all, I'm going to say this flat out. I don't think Microsoft's doing a great job with the Surface hardware right now. At least at the high end. I think the middle stuff is pretty good. I think at the high end, at least in some of the models I've seen, the performance has just not been anywhere near justifying the cost, or the cost is so high, the performance is just completely unacceptable. I have not seen or heard of a firmware update that fixes that like we had, you know, with the MacBooks that came out a couple, 3 weeks ago. So maybe there's a thermal profile that helps increase the performance on those. But, you know, I look at this and I see a stylish, easy to manage, low power, basic laptop that is going to be an accessory or a sales tool, or maybe they plan to have it integrated into enterprise environments in a tablet mode. You know, I think it's, compared to a lot of the Android and Apple tablets, I think it's, you know, you got to really love Windows and you got to, you know, it's the whole 4 gigabytes of Windows, 4 gigabytes of Windows. I was just talking to someone yesterday about how amazing it's been, because it was about 18 months, we kept seeing these entry level premium laptops, whether it was, you know, an HP, I want to say an HP Envy or some of Lenovo's or Yoga's or in the Dell XPS 13, where they had this fantastic deal, but it was 4 gigabytes of RAM and you couldn't upgrade it. Mm-hmm. And so you would end up with this device that was almost useful, or would frustrate the snot out of you. Now, you could argue that Microsoft has issues with the footprint on its operating system, or you can argue that a 4 gigabyte configuration is just dumb. This is, you know, it's good looking if you like the Surface Go looks, and I like the way they look.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, they, you know, eMMC, 64 gigabytes of eMMC is not going to help with that 4 gigabytes of RAM. You know, the 10-inch display probably looks gorgeous. Hey, you know, it is what it is. You know,
I'll say the battery life concerns me because typically when you're thinking of a device this size, kind of underperformance, not that it's awful, but it's underperforming compared to traditional notebooks that you can get. Usually the benefit you get from going to that hardware is like extended battery life. Right. And you don't, at least at first blush, you're not going to get that with this device. They only put a 26 watt hour battery in this machine, which is, you know, it's small and it's light. And there you go. Now you know why it's super light, because they only put a 26 watt hour battery in it. I will say, you know, browsing around in it, it has a very similar problem that we saw with the first generation of the Snapdragon-based machines. Mm-hmm. In Edge, things work pretty well. In Chrome, scrolling with your finger on this is a little bit stuttery, right? It doesn't feel like the same type of performance that you're used to seeing. So that was my main concern when I saw the announcement, was the use of that particular, you know, those Intel Pentium processors now, which are really just Atom processors. And then battery life, since they only claimed 9 hours on video, and that's something that usually we see on notebooks claimed at like 18 or 20, and then, you know, take your 40% hit on it for real world use. I knew it was going to be an interesting mix. So it's, you know, we saw a couple of reviews this morning that used the term like essentially all day battery life. And I just think that's wrong. I think that's very disingenuous from what we've seen so far. So not that it's not going to be a fine product. I'm going to use it for a few more days. I'll probably take it on my next trip as well and just try to see what it works, what it's like. I think this would be more interesting if it were an LTE, kind of one of those always connected devices too, again, because of the portability. That's what my mindset is now, is that it's portable. You take it with you. It's always connected. It's going to have really good battery life. And that's something that, you know, despite not selling like gangbusters, that the Qualcomm Windows machines have at least changed the dialogue and the discussion a little bit in that direction.
I also got to say is there's going to be a lot of really impressive $600-$700 machines coming out this fall that are traditional laptops. You know, they may not be in the premium tier, but it seems like everybody is pushing a lot of what you would consider premium features down into the more affordable, you know, laptop ranges. And there's going to be performance. Like I said, like 8 gigabytes of RAM is standard, you know, really good looking screen, a decent amount of storage. And, you know, yeah, I just think this is going to be a tough sell.
Yep, agreed.
So that's it for the Surface Go, I think.
For
Let's
now.
Let's talk about rumors. You pulled up an article, WCCF Tech, Intel Core i9-9900K, Core i7-9700K, Core i5-9600K, CPUs launching in October. HEDD Core X refresh launches same month, too. HKEPC pushed a roadmap online, basically the 9th generation Intel processors launching in October, and, you know, which may or may not actually happen. You know, basically performance SKUs, you know, the Core i5-9600K is just an odd part if this is how it actually specs out, because they're saying 6 cores, 6 threads, i7-9700K, 8-core, 8-thread, i9-9800K, 8-core, 16-thread. This is curious. You know, they're looking at like 3.6, or they're claiming for the 9900K, 3.6 gigahertz base clock and a 5 gigahertz boost clock in single and dual core operations, 4.8 gigahertz for 4-core boost, and then 4.7 for 6 and 8-core boost. So if they legitimately hit that across all 8 cores, WCCF Tech says that, quote, this is the highest frequency we've seen on an 8-core part across all cores. And this is all done in a 95-watt package. So we haven't seen a 95-watt. It feels like it's just after all the laptops we've looked at, that just seems like a huge amount of wattage. Does this pass the smell test for you? I got to say I was shocked. Like the, you know, i7-9700K, 8 cores, 8 threads. You know, interesting choice.
Yeah. If that, So, I don't know. So the fact that they would move up to Core i9 for this is interesting. They already did it on the mobile side, so it kind of makes sense. They went from, so they're basically, they're actually increasing core count but reducing thread count, right? So the current, right, you know, 8700K, 6 cores, 12 threads, going up to 8 cores, 8 threads is probably going to be better performance for the majority of people, right? You're going to get 8 full threads, you know, 8 full cores without having to get into the hyper-threading mess. The 9900K, 8x16, it was basically there. I mean, this is, it makes sense, right? Intel would want to match what Ryzen has done. AMD put a lot of pressure on Intel to increase its core count. So that would be over the course of two generations, Intel would be going from their top level part being quad core hyper-threaded to 8 core hyper-threaded, which is a win for everybody, right? Maybe not great for AMD. They lose that advantage that they had for a while. But instead, what they can get now is they get the ability to say that they push this forward and that they're going to be able to continue to do that in the upcoming generations. So, but I do think if that's true, if those clock speeds are right, that's pretty impressive stuff. And I think the 9900K would be a really, really compelling part. I'm also curious how Intel would price it. Are they going to, if you look at the R7 2700X today, it's what, $349, $329, and that's their 8-core part, currently priced up against just a little bit below, actually, the 8700K. So would they be willing to sell the 9900K at that same rate? I kind of doubt it. I think they'd probably go for $399, maybe $449 or something like that, knowing that their single-threaded performance is better, that they're going to maybe hit some better clock speeds. And lean on, look, the 8700K is still a wildly successful part, despite the fact that the Ryzen family is out there. So that sounds pretty interesting. They also had in that story some notes, I think, about, was it in there? The 18 core refreshes coming in the same time period this year. But nothing new on the, you know, potential for like 28 core processors. It would be a totally different socket, totally different platform.
Right.
Much more complex. Falls
refresh, Core-X processors, X299 refresh motherboards. The embargo lists up to 18 core processor with TDPs up to 165 watts. And then, quote, we are also expecting a 22-core model, while the 28-core processors would be introduced with the premium high-end family on the LGA 3647 socketed platform. So I'm going to assume, since we're talking about this, you have not received an NDA from Intel for any of this.
Correct. There you go.
All rumor, because if he'd been silent while I read that article, that would be a sign that it's... something's actually happening. While we're on the rumor mill, or while we are, you know, picking up grain at the rumor mill, there's some metaphor, there's some segue in here that I'm failing miserably at. 9to5 Mac reports Icon found in iOS 12 shows iPad with thin bezels, no home button or notch. And if you spend a lot of time looking for the future of Mac hardware, often it is found in the developer betas. And it, basically, they've been expecting an update to the iPad Pro line later this year. And if you look at those icons side by side, one of those things is not like the other, which means, who knows, we may have new iPad Pros and they may not have a home button, which would be interesting. And I thought it was kind of exciting. 5G is getting more real. You know, we've been hearing about 5G for long enough. It's hit that point where there's 5Gs announced, and then there's 5G, like a giant pile of 5G news at Mobile World Congress or CES, and then there's, you know, nothing. And then you realize it's like two or three decades out. And then there's more news. And then there's some of the news is that people are in trials and they're testing. And finally, this was up on Reuters yesterday. T-Mobile's picking up $3.5 billion worth of Nokia gear. They're calling it the world's first big 5G award. And when they say award, they mean contract. And as far as we know, it is the biggest 5G deal that's been made. And that T-Mobile's probably starting to move fast on bringing 5G to their network. So. It's interesting. You know, T-Mobile basically says they're going to deliver the first nationwide 5G service, and probably a big help to Nokia's bottom line. It's a big chunk of change coming from T-Mobile. But they're going to use the AirScale radio access platform along with cloud-connected hardware, software, and acceleration services. And yep. It's interesting. Basically, Nokia, Huawei, and Sweden are battling it out at that corner of the industry. And speaking of Huawei, has passed Apple as the second largest phone manufacturer in the world. And unfortunately, the story got accidentally erased. But this is the first time since 2010 Apple hasn't been the number one or number two in worldwide phone sales. And I thought it was crazy. Just to throw out a number to give you an idea of how many phones are sold worldwide, there were 342 million phones sold in the second quarter of 2018. That's a lot of phones.
Yep.
You know, I mean, we talk a lot about how and why the ARM processors kind of took over the universe, and that's a big part of it. That's just a lot of phones. And that's probably not even a big quarter, but
Q2 is usually a down quarter for everybody. So
yeah. So that's one of those things, like 342 million phones. It's a lot of phones, people.
The cell phone market is dying.
Hey, well, you know, we'll talk about that in a second, because their sales are actually down in a lot of areas. But first, ladies and gentlemen, we should talk about making your life a little simpler, a little bit better, a little bit easier, especially if you're buying a home. If you've ever bought a home, if you're thinking about buying a home, if you are contemplating buying a home, you need to know about Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. Rising interest rates, you know, it's finally happening. It makes things unpredictable when you're buying a home. People are getting uptight. And we're not talking about like the interest rates from the 80s where it was like 13%, but interest rates have been as low as they've ever been for a long time. They're creeping up, and it's like, oh goodness, should I rush? Should I buy the wrong house now in case it's too expensive later? Our friends over at Quicken Loans, they're trying to make things easier. They're trying to do something about that, and they're calling it the power buying process. Let me explain how it works. Quicken Loans, they're going to verify your income, your assets, your credit, less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval, which essentially gives you the strength of a cash buyer. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock you up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Gets better. This is the best part. I mean, this is great. If your rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate will also drop. It's great. I mean, either way, you win. So to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. We want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of the show. It should be easier to buy a home. So, yeah, you know, we were talking about smartphones before the break. Thank you, Rocket Mortgage. Overall market worldwide down 1.8% in Q2 2018, which is not a lot. But, Huawei's market share, 15.8%, 54 million units. And that's Huawei's doing pretty good. Samsung's still number one. And it's crazy, like they're down 10% in sales from 2017, but they are still far ahead of everybody else. So be interesting to see what happens when the Galaxy Note 9 hits in a few weeks. So Xiaomi is now head of Samsung in India. And I think Oppo is slowing down a little bit, but it's pretty crazy.
It's interesting because, you know, the Chinese market is where everybody's talking about the growth coming from. And I think what you're seeing, what you may see now after some of this, is that that actually is going to, let's lean into India. Let's lean into some other emerging markets where the growth capability is still kind of undisputed and will, you know, except will happen mm-hmm. in some kind of exceptional rate.
Well, it's
crazy. Interesting you put that. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say it's crazy when you look at some of these numbers, right? Because one, China is going down. We'll talk about that. Or China phone sales in China are definitely declining. But when you look at the year over year changes from like 2017 to 2018, Huawei's up 40%. Xiaomi's up 48.8%. You know, it's also crazy when you realize there's a whole bunch of phone manufacturers that don't make the, you know, once you get past Samsung, Huawei, Apple, Xiaomi, Oppo, you know, the rest of the, another 33.2% of the market is every other cell phone manufacturer out there.
Yeah.
So, and when you look at the raw numbers just for Q, the second quarter 2018, Samsung 71.5 million phones, Huawei 54.2 million phones, Apple 41.3 million phones, Xiaomi 31.9 million phones, Oppo 29.4 million phones. This is, again, like, you know, not to sound like the sophomore that's been drinking too much on Friday night, but that's just a lot of phones. It's amazing. That's just one quarter, the slow quarter. Yeah. I'll stop now. I look at that sometimes and I'm like,
I think it's worth mentioning as well the story you linked in there about the Apple phone. So they did their earnings, you know, now they're a $1 trillion company. iPhone sales were down 1% from last year at this time. But you know, they talk about the iPhone 10 was still the best selling phone in Q3, customer satisfaction, 98%, whatever, nobody cares. But what I found was most interesting was that the price of the average iPhone they sold went up $124 this quarter.
Yeah.
So it went from like 606 to, you know, 725 or 730. And, so even though they sold fewer units, mm-hmm. they had higher revenue in that quarter than last year because people were willing to spend more on that iPhone. And I was seeing some people talk about it as Apple's stock was hitting over this $1 trillion mark today.
Right.
Hey, remember when people were talking about the release of $99 Android phones and how smartphone was going to be this commoditized market and Apple was going to suffer because of it, because they weren't going to want to make $99 iPhones and they weren't going to reduce that. They've completely bucked that trend and, if anything, dragged everybody up with them, right? So
right.
If Apple can charge $1,200 for a phone, then Samsung feels like they can. And, you know, HTC and LG and those guys feel like they can raise their prices a little bit along the way too. And I'm, you know, I am guilty of this kind of two-way street of thinking where I believe the idea of paying $1,200 for a smartphone is kind of insane. However, I buy $1,200 smartphones. And somebody, I was talking with somebody back and forth on Twitter about it, and he made a good point of like, you just got to stop. It's not a phone anymore. You're not buying a phone. You're buying your most compact, most portable computer that has full-time connectivity, and you do more with it than almost any other device in your life. It's like, you know, and that's very true. So we will eventually peek out on how much a sizable audience is willing to spend on these devices, but we're clearly not there yet. And mm-hmm. so it'd be crazy for us to think that Apple's next phone is going to be any cheaper. And if anything, it may be more expensive.
Right? On one hand, yeah, no, I'm not arguing, but you know, the reason I'm playing around with a Moto G6 and thinking about a OnePlus 6 is because I don't want to spend $800 for, you know, for another phone when I can get mm-hmm. staggeringly good performance for considerably, you know, half as much or a third as much or a quarter of as much. Now, the camera, you know, don't get me wrong, like a Moto G6 is nowhere near as good as a flagship from Samsung or Apple or you know, Google for that matter. And even it's not as good as a second tier phone probably from Google or Apple or Samsung. But you know, especially the OnePlus 6, it's some pretty amazing camera performance compared to the phone I've been carrying for the last couple of years. And yeah, I think for a lot of people, like I'm with you, it's a super incredibly important tool that's with you all the time. And it dominates your life and your computing and your navigation and your media consumption and all that other stuff. But it's still a fragile $1,000 brick that's easy to lose or break. And I got to be honest with you, you know, when they keep getting thinner and thinner on the flagships, like I didn't mean to be the guy that breaks all the screens, but man, you know, it gets really expensive. Now, I've got a formula of a tempered glass cover, and I've figured out sort of a, you know, a case style that's kept me from breaking any more screens on my phone, at least until I, of course, walk out of here, shift my butt in the wrong direction and crack it in half. But the, you know, I'm a little frustrated with the thinness. I'm a little frustrated with the pursuit of certain aesthetics over durability. Repairability is still a nightmare on a lot of this stuff. And you know, I'm curious, right? I'm curious how far they can push it. Because boy, for some of these flagship phones, I mean, you can get a really nice laptop. You're not going to carry a laptop with you and you're not going to get 4G LTE, but you know, I also have things to say about, you know, being a large data consumer professionally and how impossible it's getting to get large amounts of data on a new, if I like to move carriers, I'm going to lose basically any opportunity to deal with, like, typically in a bad month, like a CES month, I do 25, 30 gigabytes of data. And it's, I'm basically going to have to buy another, you know, I'm going to have to buy a special phone or hotspot just to deal with that at CES this year. Because if I do change carriers, none of them are particularly interested in large data consumers anymore. And they're going out of their way to sort of minimize the opportunity for that. Even if you want to pay out of pocket, they don't want to create the opportunity for you to do so. So,
I mean, eventually they're not going to have a choice, right? Like, eventually everybody will be a high data consumer. That's just the way it's going to be. But the question will be, will the people at the, you know, top 10% always remain at the top 10%, or will it homogenize a little bit down? So if you would just stop downloading all those movies and stuff, Patrick, we'd be fine.
Yeah, it's the uploading like 3 gigabytes to YouTube that's the problem.
Yeah.
China smartphone market declined for the fourth consecutive quarter into Q2 2018. That's Counterpoint Research wrote this one up. Quote, Huawei was the fastest and lone brand registering a positive 22% year-over-year growth, leading the market with an all-time record share. Huawei's sub-brand Honor also individually surpassed Xiaomi in overall volumes during the quarter, leading the e-commerce channel share as well. It's funny. They smartphone shipments in China, quote, declined 7% annually but grew sequentially, and the top five brands captured 84% of the market. Essentially, it's an analyst write-up. James Yan wrote this up for Counterpoint. Huawei, Oppo, Vivo, Xiaomi, and Apple combined did 84% of the market. Did I just read that right? Math is hard. 84% of the market. Up from like 72% of the market last year. And Oppo's down 9%, Vivo's down 1%, Xiaomi's down 10%, Apple's basically holding at 8 or 9% of the Chinese market, and everybody else dropped 37%. So I wonder if we're finally seeing a lot of the smaller cell phone vendors being beaten out of contention in China and the rest of the world. But it was interesting. I just thought that was kind of interesting. The place where everybody's like, that's where all the memory's going. That's where all the sales are going. That's why you can't buy memory anywhere. So I'll be curious to see if phone sales in China keeps going down. It makes me wonder if we're going to start seeing some easing on the memory prices. You know, I also really can't wait for Samsung's memory fabs to come along. And I was really excited because one of them actually, I think they flipped the switch on it July 4th. We talked about it earlier this year that Samsung would be bringing new fabs online and memory fabs. And one of the first ones to come online is a fourth generation VNAND or 64-layer VNAND factory, adding to the company's leading capacity for cutting-edge memory products. So I was kind of excited until I realized that 64-layer VNAND is not PC memory. It's SSD memory. And the upside of that is we'll probably be creeping closer to Ryan's theoretical ideal SSD price of 10 cents per gigabyte. So
we got very close. We're so very close. Yeah, I was actually reading an article earlier about the price of NAND memory trending down over the last few months. The outlet called DRAM Exchange, kind of an analyst group that follows things in the memory space really closely, expecting a drop of 10% in Q3 and another 10% drop in Q4 of this year, citing lower market demand and increased output as the reason behind the price drop. Bad for the stocks of maybe like Samsung and Hynix and Micron in the short term, but better for the consumers, better for the implementers that are, buying this memory and putting it on new devices. I think we always kind of knew this would occur, right? We were at a high point once more capacity came online, things would settle down. I still think we have spikes in demand coming as more IoT devices and AI devices start coming online themselves. Yeah. We'll see some of that. But hey, it's nice to know that these companies didn't just leave their new fabrication facilities offline in perpetuity to maintain high price points.
Right. It's a plus. We appreciate that, memory manufacturers. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. when you look at, 16 gigabytes, like Corsair Vengeance LPX, 16 gigabytes, 2 8-gigabyte sticks of DDR4, 3000 megahertz. That was down around, summer of 2016. You were looking at $70 for 16 gigabytes of RAM, more typically anywhere between January and January 2016, almost all the way through December of 2017, or maybe early 2017, you're still looking at $100 for 16 gigabytes. And then, spring of 2017, the memory prices just started climbing up and up and up, peaked out at in excess of $200 for 16 gigabytes right around Christmas this year. And, they're vacillating a lot, anywhere between $160 and $180, depending on what day you're buying. That's still more than twice what it was at the bottom. But it's much better than three times what it was at the bottom. So we got that to look forward to. Goodness. SK Hynix building more fab capacity too. Nantech's got a write-up on that. Basically, they announced last week they're going to be building another semiconductor fab in Incheon, South Korea. Hopefully I said that right. $3.13 billion to put that puppy together. And so it looks like, I don't think they've gotten too specific about what's going to happen at the fab. Man, they've got a lot of DRAM and NAND capability there across all of their factories. Basically, they said they're going to build a new fab, but just not going to say what they're going to build there. And they're going to wait until, quote, they can consider future market conditions. So, they want to secure a future growth engine and they want to take advantage of high memory prices, but they're going to wait as long as possible till they commit themselves to whatever memory is going to make them the most money out of that warehouse. So, GTX, yep. We had GTX 1170 rumors in the last show. We're now having GTX 1180 rumors. And did you say a GTX 2080?
Well, I think the debate is still going back on whether or not they're going to call it the GTX 1180 or GTX 2080 or something else completely, because depending on which website you read on which hour, they're going to have a slightly different rumor and story about all these types of things. So this just happened to be the most recent one that I saw. They're calling it the 1180. There are rumors that I saw this morning of a Hong Kong-based outlet registering a product called Ampere, and it was called the 2080. So that name hadn't come out in a little while. We had been hearing Volta and Turing, and now Ampere spikes back up again. The new stuff in here are these PCB shots that apparently leaked out. Now, what's interesting is they show there's some things you can tell. It's literally only a PCB. There's no GPU on it. There's no memory on it. The SLI connection or NVLink connection is different. It's unique from anything we've seen previously. Even NVLink is flipped in slightly different pin count than that. This has an 8-pin plus 6-pin power connection. So giving you an idea that, you know, the GTX 1080 is just one 8-pin. So this is going to be higher end than that, either in terms of pricing or performance or both. All the stories are assuming this is a GeForce product. It could be a workstation class product. It could be a Volta-based product. This could literally be just about anything. But all that aside, this is the whole point of the speculative rumor mill that is sometimes fun, sometimes frustrating to watch, is that, you know, they're talking about 8 gigs or 16 gigs of memory, GDDR6 memory on it. They call them new SLI fingers. I don't like that term, but it's SLI interconnect. Hey, it is what it is. So it's kind of interesting. And again, according to this story, the release will be the 1180 would be August 30th. The 1180 Plus would be September 30th, 1170 September 30th, and 1160 October 30th. So kind of spreading those out a little bit. 1180 Plus is kind of interesting. It would be a new nomenclature. I don't know if they just don't want to say 1180 Ti with that anymore, but, you know, plus seems a little odd, but we'll see.
We wait with bated breath.
Hopefully not much longer.
I mean, are you feeling it's time to warn people to not buy a premium GPU?
Probably. I think, yeah. Probably, yeah. I'll just say yes. We're already in August, and NVIDIA is having an event at Gamescom where they've, you know, apparently invited people out, and there's all these rumors are percolating with August 30th dates for some of that. But I have no idea. I would bet that NVIDIA would be raising prices along with performance to some degree as well. So if you find a good deal, you know, a 1080 and a 1070 Ti, those are still fantastic gaming cards. So,
yeah. I mean, they're all the 1060, the 1070, the 1080. They're all phenomenal performers. I don't think. Do you anticipate anything that's going to make you sort of bang your head against the desk and be like, I should have waited? It's 70% faster. It costs half as much. It'll polish my shoes.
Probably not. I mean, the 1080 jump was pretty significant as it is. I would be surprised if we see that big of a jump, but it has been 2 years, right? Like it's been a pretty long wait. So it wouldn't blow me out of the water if we're seeing 40% out of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the question is, it will be 40% for the same retail MSRP right. or street price, or will it be 40% for a significantly increased MSRP and street price? Yep. We'll let you know as soon as we figure it out. In other news, since we seem to be talking, it's everybody's been announcing, doing their financials and stuff. I've never seen this website before. This is insider.com, but I guess it's business. It's sort of a corner of Business Insider I've never been on before. Apple sold 13% fewer Macs this quarter, proving that its future hinges on iPhone and iPad. And, you know, it's 13% over the same quarter in 2017. I'm really kind of curious, how things look at the end of the year for sort of MacBook sales. And it's interesting, right? 3.7 million units sold on, you know, across the Mac lineups. That's down 9% from the quarter before. Again, this is a kind of a short quarter for the year, for most years. 13% fewer than the same period in 2017, right. 5% drop in Mac revenue from the same period in 2017. And, you know, we've talked about it, not so much in the last year, but there were a couple of years there where it seemed like every week there was some new study basically explaining how no one was going to be using laptops next year, and that nobody was really using desktops now except for a few obscure programmers and media creation people. The death of the PC is going to be much more slow and gradual than I think a lot of the more hyped up reports would say, and may actually never happen. But it's interesting, right? You know, there was so much trouble with the 2016 models of the MacBook Pro. They launched the 2018 models. There were some issues with that. The keyboard fails kind of drove off a lot of people. But the interesting thing is that they're pointing out here is that, 3.7 million Macs that quarter, 41.3 million iPhones. And, the suggestion, the thought they're having at Business Insider is that developers are not going to be as stoked for developing on the Mac OS as they would be for iOS due to the sheer volume of customers that are available. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's a pretty diehard community and a lot of people that are fully vested in their Macs, but I've had a lot of people in the last 6 months, ask me about moving from OS X to Windows and what that would entail because they've been so frustrated with the hardware situation at Apple. And Apple certainly got the money, and since they got called out on the willingness, for example, to update the keyboards on the older Macs that had such a tremendously awful keyboard design. But, the other thing they're kind of suggesting is that, maybe they're just not doing as good a job engineering the laptops as they used to in the past because most of their focus is on the phones. I'm really curious. It's been a long time. Content and apps and iPhones have been the vast majority of what generated revenue at Apple for a long time. This is not exactly news, mm-hmm. but I'm very curious to see what Apple does over the next couple of years because it seems like they've made a lot of tremendous mistakes around what I think is a pivotal content creator tool. The MacBook Pro. I'm kind of really curious to see because how could they have not figured out the TDP problems before releasing this MacBook? They fixed them fairly quick, which means they should have, either they knew what was going to happen and launched it anyway because they were almost done with the repair, or nobody there bothered to actually do any real testing with strenuous apps. I don't know how to respond to that. That's just, it's not the Apple we grew up with. It's not the Apple of my father. It's not the Apple of my youth. I mean, I'm curious. I'm very curious. They're selling probably more smartwatches than anybody else on the planet right now. iPhone sales are doing pretty good, but I'm kind of curious to see where they are with the rest of their hardware in a year or two. And if you're really excited about really dense spreadsheets, you can actually look at the revenue breakdowns, like 41.3 million iPhones. Is that units in that revenue? 29, almost 30. It can't be right. 30. I think it would be 30 billion in revenue. Could that be right? I'm having trouble reading this spreadsheet's so small. I can't read it. It's just, you're looking at like 1/6 the revenue. Services generates twice as much money as the Mac. Other products generates nearly as much money as the Mac. iPads generate almost as much, maybe it's like maybe 15% less. Like iPads, what's the last time you saw somebody buy a new iPad? In any case, interesting to watch the goings on in Apple. If you're seeing Nintendo Switches everywhere, it's because they are. Compared to the Wii, this thing is staggeringly popular. 19.7 million consoles racked up, 87 million games to date. If you are into the Nintendo ROM scene, some developments coming up on the Switch are basically why a bunch of the ROM sites have been legally stomped out of existence. You know, this is, they're doing pretty good. Little old Nintendo.
19.7 million consoles, which compares that they've sold so far of the Switch. The Nintendo Wii U sold 13.6 in total.
Yeah.
But also in comparison, the Nintendo 3DS sold almost 73 million. So, you know, they're within, you know, 20-25% of the 3DS sales already. I think that's probably more successful than anybody would have guessed at this point in time. It's a lot of money. That's what it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, because when you look at the 3DS, the sales on that started February 26th in 2011 and ran for a long time.
I think they might still be running. I think now they've backed off to the 2DS, but I don't know if the 3DS is sold anymore. But it was fairly recently. So, yes, it had a long run to get up to that number. And it had sustained sales rates for almost the entirety of that period. And so the Switch has done better. I know from personal experience that a lot of my friends have been buying them for their kids, for their birthdays and stuff. It's kind of the return of that for Nintendo. So yeah, after the success of the Wii and the failure of the Wii U, the success here is a welcome change for them.
Absolutely. And the other one that made me laugh, in Gadget's title, Sony can't stop making money from PlayStation.
Yeah. So the interesting thing there is in this past quarter in Q2, they sold 3.2 million PlayStation 4s, which is only 100,000 less than they sold during the same period last year, despite the fact that, you know, there's all the rumors circulating about new PlayStations with new processors and faster performance and all of that. So the fact that they sold 3.3 million in Q2 last year and 3.3 million this year is pretty impressive. And they apparently sold 40 million games in that same time period as well.
That's
a lot.
A lot. Yeah.
$750 million in profit from the PlayStation arm. Yeah. I'd be very curious. I don't know if I don't think Microsoft breaks out Xbox into its own. It combines it with some other things, but my guess would be it's not quite to that level.
Well, PlayStation 4 is doing all right, and new games for that should be coming for quite some time. Actually, new games for the 3DS should be coming for quite some time too. So. I don't know. A lot of console news this week, some odd news in hardware, but I thought it was fun to cover because now we know where all the memory's going. Less of it's going into phones in China, more of it's going into phones in India, and a lot of it's going into PlayStations. So,
yeah.
Come on, Samsung. Get those new fabs online. Let's drop those memory prices down. Oh, my goodness. Anything you can tease? I mean, other than the, you know, whatever GPU news you can't talk about because lawyers drop from the ceiling with hammers and beat you senseless. But so anything you'll talk about that's coming up?
You'll have Threadripper 2 results this month, right? Like Threadripper 2000 series is going to be soon. The GeForce stuff is happening at the end of the month. I don't know when the embargoes are going to be on performance or all that, but if there's new products coming out, it will likely be at the end as well. And it sounds like September and October are going to be busy too if Intel's leaked roadmaps hold up to scrutiny as well. So I don't know. It doesn't seem like we've ever slowed down. This is a lot of it. A lot of this is thanks to AMD and their processor division ever since the release of the first Ryzen parts, kind of jumping everybody, leapfrogging them a little bit. So everybody's playing catch up, and NVIDIA does not have that pressure, but they're like, geez, I guess maybe we've had these GPUs long enough. We'll probably start to sell them now. So it's good for everybody.
We've been stopped.
Maybe not Radeon, but good for everybody else. Selling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they could start if they could. You know what? I'll look at GPU prices next week. We'll take a look at some of the Radeon pricing and availability versus the GTX. But man, it's like MSRP and occasionally hints of below MSRP pricing. And I was actually kind of shocked at how much variance there was in the prices on some of the 1050 Ti and 1060 parts. because we were talking about that on Tech Thing this week. But yeah, if you've been waiting to build a system, it's time.
Yep.
Go to thepcpro.com/leaderboard. There are many good ideas there. Don't forget, if you're building a Ryzen system, you got to buy a GPU because there ain't no graphics on the chip. Just want to lay that out there. So some of the savings they talk about so much in the motherboard chip combinations does not survive. You're gonna have, you can drop at least like $50 for some kind of a GPU to make sure you connect a monitor to your computer, unless you want to run headless. And if you're doing that, you're probably some sort of hardcore FreeBSD or Linux guru, and you're probably not listening to this podcast. If you are listening to this podcast, we're called This Week in Computer Hardware, and we are over at twit.tv/twitch if you want to find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe. The handsome man with all the benchmarking knowledge is Mr. Ryan Shrout. You can find him over at pcpro.com. My name is Patrick Norton. You can find more of me at techthing, T-E-K-T-H-I-N-G, and avxl.com. And we want to thank you so much for your support of the show. And hey, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.